The people giving off carbon dioxide as they breathe, that was supposed to be absorbed by the plants, and the plants were supposed to give you oxygen in return. And I think in a short period of time, they were running low on oxygen. The plants were not photosynthesizing fast enough. Somebody had done an error in calculation, and they weren't getting enough oxygen off the plants. Is that roughly what happened, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
There it is. And they had scrubbers on, involved, which were plugged into the outside. You know, theoretically, you would have, a million acres of solar panels out there developing electricity with nuclear power plants supplying this so-called spaceship that would be flying to Mars. And they just couldn't keep up with it. But they did bring some oxygen, and it just wasn't figured right. But, I mean, they were close. They did live there for 2 years, had animals and everything on board, for food, a desert, had wetlands, tons of capabilities of growing foods. They did do all that. And it was completely enclosed. It's still out there. It's out in it's out in the middle of Arizona. And Arizona University actually took it up, bought it up. They were going to demolish it, put a mall out there. But Arizona University came to the rescue and saved it. They're using it for experiments now. The first mission, I'll call it a mission, was 1991 with 8 people, 4 men, 4 women. And then they had another one, I think it lasted about 8 months, but they had some financial problems. They shut it down. But this group was, they did it. I mean, they were in an enclosed space. They did start to run out of oxygen. But the people that took all, that were in there, there were 8 of them, 2 of them, Jane Pointer and her now husband, now run Paragon Space. It's a reputable company. They've done set up research projects not only for Mir, but for the shuttle system, the space lab, and for now the International Space Station. It's a reputable, very reputable group, this Paragon. They set up another company called Worldwide. They plan on having space adventures, not with a rocket, but with balloons. I mean, it's coming from reputable people. And you're right about it, the oxygen and all. And, they did a great job. The amount of spaces, all these domes were 3.14 acres of land. Glad they set it up like that, because I don't have a memory like yours. It's easy to remember 3.14. And that's the amount of acreage they had. It was nice that they did that. Back to you, Dick.
When you set up something that big, you and I know that no matter how hard you try, sealing up all the windows and cracks and everything else of your house breathes. An ordinary house does a complete exchange of its air every couple of hours because of the leakage rate. And if you did a super good sealing job, maybe you could make it 12 hours. But when you're taking something that's 3.14 acres, it's got a whole lot of windows and a whole lot of joints, to make all of those joints thoroughly airtight is difficult. And what do they do for the floor? If you develop this dome over the dirt, well, the dirt is going to breathe at a certain rate. Do they have the equivalent of a floor on these domes that made it thoroughly airtight? That's question number one. And whether or not it's airtight is pretty easy to test. You just put an exhaust fan somewhere and find out if you start developing a vacuum or an overpressure. You can find out real fast what your leakage rate is. However, the sunlight is shining through these panes of glass like a greenhouse onto the plants, and you want the plants to be converting sunlight into photosynthesis and sucking up carbon dioxide and giving off oxygen. However, some of what that plant does is with ultraviolet light to give full efficiency out of the plant. You need ultraviolet light. And many kinds of glass, the ultraviolet light does not penetrate the glass, the panes of window on this super big hothouse, if you know what I mean. And so maybe the plants gave them less oxygen because they weren't getting enough ultraviolet light. So you got a combination of leakages going on, insufficient photosynthesis, and I guess with eight people, they weren't creating enough oxygen. So these guys, I presume they were continuously measuring the oxygen, and they were getting below 20% where people were starting to feel a little bit foggy-brained. Is that sort of what happened, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW, on Biosphere number one.
Yes, it is. And they did run into an unusual problem with the weather. Now, theoretically, this is flying along in space. You can have clouds. Here they had clouds they didn't know what to do with. And that caused a decrease in growth. And, you know, well, I think you would like this book. I don't know. You probably don't have the time, but it's a great book by Jane Poynter. Called 2 Years and 20 Minutes. 2 Years and 20 Minutes. Because that's the exact time that she was in this biosphere. It's, you know, basically her life story, how she got there, this group that she was got involved with. The eight people that were involved, you know, they had a doctor. He's a little older. He's deceased now. He died. But they had people that were experts in plants, food, and manufacturing, you know, how to keep oxygen going. And really a good group. And there was a lot of media stories that it was, you know, almost like a cult. But, it came out of a... It was funded by a group that was kind of cult-like. But, I mean, the guy was a billionaire or something. So, once you read this book, you realize that, you know, stories that were involved with this thing were, you know, nothing to take too seriously. They were a dedicated group, and especially the ones that were personally involved with it. Really good story. 20 minutes. Back to you.
Yeah, I've got a series of other questions here, Paul. Roughly how many dollars was the financing of the whole thing? I think you said the experiment got run twice, and one of those periods was 2 years and 20 minutes. The people inside the biosphere have to be acting like farmers. In other words, they're growing their own food. So they're continuously planting and cultivating and weeding and doing whatever. And when you and I do farming on the earth, in order to make the farming efficient, we most likely are going to be pouring some fertilizer into the soil. And we completely forget about the fact that no matter what you use for fertilizer, it's doing outgassing of various things. Well, when you're on your little X number of acre farm on Long Island, you're pouring on an acre's worth of fertilizer and it outgassed, the atmosphere easily absorbs it. When you're in this completely closed biosphere, whatever the outgassing of your fertilizer is something you got to worry about. It might be toxic to human beings. So you got these people continuously doing farming in order to make the food they're going to eat. You're hoping the plants and the trees and bushes and everything else are giving you a lot of oxygen back in return. And you're worrying about whether or not there's enough ultraviolet light coming in to make the plants efficient. And you did say that there was a problem with clouds. Were the clouds on the inside of the biosphere or the clouds in the atmosphere above the biosphere in Arizona? So where were the clouds that were giving them grief, Paul? I got a bunch of questions there, as you can tell. WS2N, KQRIW.
The clouds was, weather phenomenon. They didn't expect that in Arizona. It gave them basically too much shade, let's put it that way. Not enough sunlight. It was what they wanted to do. So, first time in, 50 years, and they picked the wrong year from 1991 to 1993. That 1 year gave them problems. If you talk about fertilizer, they didn't have fertilizer. I mean, this was a group that knew how to take what was ever left over, and they would, you know, that would become the fertilizer. They didn't, you know, there were no, you know, chemicals brought in to do anything, as far as I remember. I'm going back quite a few years now since I read that book, but and this was a real, you know, all natural, organic kind of facility, so no chemicals involved. They didn't have animals and everything. They were raising it and cooking it. I mean, their plans were just to keep this going forever. They were going to leave, and have a new group come in and take over. I mean, this was supposed to keep going. It did leave, and new group did come in soon afterwards, and they lasted about, I think, 8 months. Back to you, Dick.
Who financed this, Paul, and how many dollars were the financing? And I get the impression now that the total duration was 2 years and 20 minutes plus 8 months. Call it 3 years. Where did the financing come from? And after the second group of people for 8 months, was there a lack of oxygen there too? What created the lack of enthusiasm that made the project a stop? So our first question is, who financed it and roughly how many dollars? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, there was money problems, and like any organization where there's a big pile of money, things started to go wrong. And the feds raided the offices, took the files out, the computers were on. I don't know what computers they had back then, but 1993. But they took all the files and stuff, and they had some problems. There might have been somebody playing with the money or something. I don't know. I think it was 500. I'm going to guess. I'm going back a couple of years. I think it was $500 million. Something like that. And there was one guy that was really funding this. I remember his first name. Ted something or other. I'll have to look it up. He's still around. And some kind of businessman. And he had a lot of... I think he was involved with oil, and I don't know, he had investments in Australia or something. You know, the guy had a lot of money, and he was basically paying the tab on this thing, and he's a big believer in this type of thing, and that's pretty much where it comes from. I'm going to guess around $500 million.
Now, you and I have seen science fiction movies where you do have a... biosphere-like section of this great big spacecraft that's taking a very long trip, and you'd like to believe that the ship is manufacturing its own food and oxygen and whatever, taking sunlight input to do all this. Here we had 3.14 acres trying to support 8 human beings, and it looks to me like that was marginal, and so the amount of area and volume you have to devote to a spacecraft to do this is such that I can tell that some other method of recycling is going to have to take place when it comes to Mars One. I have to cycle every single molecule that comes out of a human being, solids, liquids, and gases. All of that has to be recycled in order to sustain life, because to have enough consumables on board, I mean, base of the tons of stuff that's brought up multiple times per year by the Progress ships to the International Space Station. Let me drop. From that you find out real fast that to maintain a human being requires a lot of liquids, solids, and gases. And it's not easy to recycle all of that, to put all the energy back in. Wow. You'd like to think you can do it with a great big farm. You got to be a lot more efficient than that. Mars One, if they're going to do it similar to what the biosphere did, I think they'd need 6 acres of area to do it. Well, to put 6 acres of area into space under zero G, wow. Out of the question as I see it. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Well, what came out of that is intelligence, a lot of these people, especially Jane Poynter and her husband. They come out of that thing, and they planned on going into business when they were in Biosphere 2, and they did, and again, they became Paragon Space Industries, and well-respected with NASA, developing, recycling type of systems, including spacesuits and all, and now they have a spinoff called Worldview. In charge of that, Worldview is a group of you can have a group of people of a total of 8, co-pilots called that, and 6 tourists that will get on board a capsule-like piece of equipment with no space, just get in there, sit down, pick any seat, because you're going to have windows all around. You're going to have a view, 360 degrees. You're going to launch in a helium balloon. You're going to go up, let's go 20 miles or something. And, you know, it's going to be completely encapsulated. You won't have to worry about anything. The only person that will be in a spacesuit will be the pilot, co-pilot, in case there's a problem. They need to, drive a red bushy-tail to get this thing back. Now, the balloon is hanging with a parafoil. Parafoil will be bended, hanging from this helium balloon that's as big as Shea Stadium. You're going to get up there. And it's going to take you, a couple hours or something, I think 2 hours or something to get up there. And you'll get to have the best view going. You can see the curvature of the Earth. You'll have a bathroom up there. If you want to head to the bathroom, you'll have that facility. You want to get a cocktail, they'll probably give you that too. They've wrote it up like that. You'll be released from the balloon on this parasail. Parasail will take you down. Pilot will take it down to actually a runway somewhere down in the middle of Arizona somewhere. That's where they're headquartered. And for this thrill, you're going to pay $70,000. How about that, Dick? $70,000.
That sounds at least possible, Paul. That I can see as if Virgin One, Virgin Galactic, I think is the name of the company. I can't think of his name. What's the name of the guy who's the head of that company?
Yeah, that's Branson, Virgin Galactic, you're right. Yeah, he's got a long way to go. He's got to recoup from that disaster last year.
Yeah, Branson can pull that off, and there's enough people out there that want to experience being in space, depending on which article you read. Space is 50 miles up or 100 kilometers, something like this. And you want to see the curvature of the Earth, you want to see the blackness of the atmosphere, the blackness of sky, and experience some weightlessness. That's all possible. But in the case of Mars One, where you're stuck inside of these little igloos most of the time, you think you're going to go out there and do some farming in your spacesuit, and therefore you're going to be in that spacesuit for a lot of hours on a lot of days. Those words roll off the tongue real easily. To really do that, you talk to an astronaut who has spent 6, 7, possibly 8 hours in a spacesuit doing an extravehicular activity. The amount of maintenance required to make sure that all the systems in that spacesuit and the life support system are working correctly, tremendous amount of maintenance and checking has to take place. The astronaut literally wears a high absorbent diaper. To do that for 6 or 7 hours, your body can maybe tolerate that. Maybe you won't get too much diaper rash. Imagine day in and day out, I think you're going to be in a spacesuit because you need mobility outside of the igloo on the surface of Mars, and you think all of these spacesuits are going to be properly maintained under those conditions. You get a minor leak in one of the seals of that spacesuit, and it's life-threatening. It could be game over real fast. There's a lot of details here of the consumables required and the living in an atmosphere that has essentially no real air to it, no real air pressure, ridiculously bad temperatures, ridiculously bad environment as far as atmosphere, 200 mile an hour winds that blow periodically, dust storms, and it's a one-way trip. You go there.
Repeater, timeout.
The average person who goes there is going to be pretty tired of it after a couple of weeks, and he knows he's got to spend the rest of his life there, because there's no way to get back home. There are people who will volunteer for that, but I think those people have not gotten into the details of what life there is going to really be like. It's a, by comparison to the worst slum you could live in anywhere on planet Earth, it's going to seem like heaven compared to the conditions you're going to live in there. What would you call WS2N, KQRIW?
Dick, you think they're going to give them cyanide tablets?
And you've made an awful big investment to put those people there, and to end that way, seems like a waste. Go ahead, Paul.
Comment.
Okay, very good. If somebody wants to make a comment, Dick, maybe you should let them take it. cyanide tablets. Wow. You know, that was always a rumor. Never true from what I read. Back to you, sir.
A person with comment, please give us your call letters and name and then proceed with your comment, sir.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and the rest of the group. This is Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. I just wonder, how many diapers can you really send to Mars?
That's a darn good point. How many diapers can you send, and how do you recycle those diapers? You got an idea on that one?
I really don't want to think about it.
If I have it. Yeah, there's a thought. I'm gonna have trouble getting out of my head now for a while. very good. They don't even have good water systems on board the International Space Station. You know, all the water that they're drinking, using, they're in these bags, you know, big gigantic bags that they keep bringing up on all these different flights. They don't even have tanks on the International Space Station. They don't have fresh water tanks to charge or discharge. And that's coming to in fact, they've already taken tanks out of the old space shuttles. These 3-foot-long tanks, little about 1.5 feet in diameter. Cylinders, really. And especially made for fresh water and also for drainage water. They're going to eventually set these things back up to the space station. We don't even have it on our International Space Station. You're going to need tanks on interplanetary flights. You're going to need them on the planet itself. You know, you just can't do what this guy wants to do for Mars One. I mean, he's dreaming. He thinks, you know, like the Field of Dreams. If he builds it, you know, the billionaires are going to come and support him. Well, they're not lining up. This is WS2N. I just want to go over a couple of other things. The idea is to eventually get to Mars quicker. NASA's giving out another contract for Bessemer engine. I've talked about Bessemer engine in the past. It's a variable specific impulse magna plasma rocket that's being developed by AdAsta. AdAsta is the name of the company that's developing these things. They've run quite a few tests on it, and it's similar to an ion engine, but more powerful. Ion engines develop very little thrust, maybe as much as you could if you took a piece of paper from a loose leaf binder and put it in your hand. That's about all the thrust you're going to get out of it. And they work great. They put them on the Dawn spacecraft. They put them on. They put it on the Smart spacecraft, Smart One. They're now on spacecraft that are using it to set themselves up in geosynchronous orbit inexpensively. It's a lot less expensive to do it with xenon gas than it is to use chemical fuels. So it's become a big thing, but the Bessemer engine is similar, but it develops a lot more thrust. They heat the gas instead of a xenon gas. They're heating up like helium, and the way they heat it up is using RF, and they heat it up to a very high temperature. I haven't figured out the temperatures yet. They blow it out the back, and the way they blow it out is with magnetic, you know, it becomes ionized, and somehow, after it becomes ionized, the magnetic waves affect it. You know, you can direct the blow of this stuff, and they can blow it out the back of a rocket engine using a magnetism, but to get this RF heat and to operate this thing, it does take a lot of energy. You know, like thousands of watts would be more about better. You know, if you have a megawatt system, it would be great. And there was plans a couple of years ago of actually attaching this thing to the space station, and there still are plans in the future to use it as a constant thrust to keep the space station, International Space Station, in orbit instead of using all these chemical rockets from the Progress ships that keep going up there from the Russians. Well, when we went up with the shuttle, we used to help boost the space station up. So this Vastmar engine, it's in development, and they've run quite a few tests, like 10,000 tests, and they seem to work. They can turn it on and off 10,000 different times. So the head of the company is an ex-astronaut, retired. And he plans on, eventually developing this. He's been after NASA for years to fund it, and now he's going to get some funding of I don't know how many millions of dollars, but his name's Franklin Diaz, Franklin Jane Diaz. He comes out of Costa Rica, and he flew for NASA for many years as an American astronaut. Seven different flights on the shuttle. I don't know how many EVAs. So the guy knows what he's doing, and he's been actually working on this Vastmar engine when he was younger, and still at it. So that would be good. I mean, you could apply some kind of thrust and get there in, maybe 3 or 4 months instead of 8 months. So, I mean, it's one way around it. We'll see, and also be able to keep a space station possibly in orbit for longer periods of time. I have more things, Dick, but, I know I'm going to eat up too much time. Probably have already. K2RIWWS2S.
Yeah, don't worry, Paul. It's good stuff. A fair number of the emails that John and I get are people who really enjoy the space stuff report, like knowing what NASA is doing. And so, good stuff. Let me see what I'm doing here. Oh, I see what's going on. Got one of my receivers set wrong. Sure enough, now I know where the feedback is coming from. a diaper problem. Jonathan brought that to our attention. KC2SHO. How do you know if you've got enough diapers on Mars to support the Mars One mission? And how do you recycle them? Oh, boy. I can remember when our children were young. Doesn't that... There's a help of recycles every single molecule human beings use, whether it be the stuff that flows through their body or the stuff that they use for their farming and agriculture and industry and moving their automobiles and so on. Everything, to some degree, gets recycled. And we take an awful lot of that for granted. And you suddenly go into space where you've now got to supply all of that. To maintain a human being in space requires a lot of resources. The total number of pounds per year of consumables that are brought up by the Progress light ships to the International Space Station. Each Progress ship, I'm going to guess, brings up 4,000 pounds of stuff. And they do that with about 5 times per year or more, if that's true. That's 20,000 pounds of stuff to maintain 6 human beings on the International Space Station. My numbers might even be low. So consumables are a real problem. Over to you, Paul, on that one. WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, that's about right. Four or five flights. They cut back a little bit last time because the Progress, they lost the one Progress ship, and they needed to find out what the problem was. And I think they'll probably get in 3 this year. And maybe 4 by December, I don't know. Roughly 4,000 to 5,000 pounds, I guess. The other spacecraft that bring up supplies are the SpaceX Dragon spacecraft. That cargo spacecraft brings up about the same, probably about 5,000 to 6,000 pounds. The only good thing is with SpaceX, we're able to bring down about, I think the most they can bring is around 1,800 pounds, something like that. They brought back, science experiments and things like that. It's the only one that brings stuff back. Yeah, Progress brings back a little bit. They have some kind of a canister that dislodges from, on the way back from orbit. might get a couple of kilograms or something that are coming back. It might bring, 100 pounds back from when three people come back on a space voyage on a Soyuz spacecraft. But everything going up, you need a big spacecraft like the one that's up there now, the H-2, built by Japan. Sent up a week or so ago. It took about 5 days to get there. Docked with the International Space Station. Should say berth with the, there's a difference between docking and berthing, but it berthed with the space station using the robotic arm, and that carries a lot of stuff, roughly about 10,000 pounds. And you gotta remember, they carry more than the Falcon 9 because they don't need a spacecraft filled with parachutes and heat shields and all this heavy stuff that SpaceX needs to bring its spacecraft back. So all that stuff is just a one-way trip. They load it up with garbage and they deorbited, landed into the, or crashed into the Pacific Ocean. The ATV is gone. That was about three times the amount of progress. That's the automatic transfer vehicle built by European Space Agency. They fulfilled their contracts of five different flights that have gone up over the years. And they were great. Very big spacecraft. Plenty of fuel, plenty of food, plenty of everything. And I don't know. It's an amazing system that's up to $100 billion projects. That I think is well worth it. A lot of science has gone up there, and science is still coming back. I think, for instance, Mark Kelly's involved with some 400 different experiments on the space station for his one-year flight. Him and his counterpart from Russia. They'll be coming back in March. That's not supposed to be the end of it. Eventually, after that, another one-year mission should be, should also be going up there. They're going to continue on with that. Actually, it's a lot cheaper, too. You can leave somebody up in space a lot longer. And hopefully by 2017, we'll be able to have some flights from the American soil, either with SpaceX or with Boeing, or with their CST-100 back either.
I'm pretty sure you've told us in the past, but I'm a little bit forgetful. In the case of a progress ship, it brings up 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of materials, and you have to tell us the difference between docking and berthing. For the to the naive person, it sounds like it's a similar procedure. I mean, the spacecraft connects itself with an airtight seal with docking arrangement of some kind to the International Space Station. You're able to open the door and start unloading the stuff. Of docking versus berthing, you're going to have to tell us what that is. But in the case of the Progress ship, after you are through using it, I guess you do a deorbit burn, it hits the atmosphere, and getting the impression the majority of it burns up, you got this canister that can be released from the Progress during reentry, and I guess it comes down on a parachute, and so some material is recoverable, but I guess the majority of Progress either completely burns up or whatever is left over goes into the Pacific Ocean. Is that approximately what happens, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, that's what happened to all the cargo vehicles, the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle by the European Space Agency, the Progress, of course, like you just mentioned. It all burns up over the Pacific, as well as the H-2, built by Japan, that's attached to the space station now. Launched on the by the H-2B rocket from Takashima, Japan. It's a nice, good design, solar panels just surrounding the film. They got a good design where SpaceX and the automatic transfer vehicle have these solar panels that come out from it. Makes it a lot more complicated, but doable. Just more weight. Japan has fixed that problem. Berthing situation. You have, like, the docking is really done by, spacecraft. The Russians do all docking, by the way. Let me drop it. whether it's a manned mission or a progress mission. The American side, we do both. We do berthing and we do docking. There's an advantage and disadvantage of both. Just the other day, for instance, they had to relocate a Soyuz spacecraft from one port on the Russian side to another port. Russian side has four different ports they could locate. They needed to clear up one of the other ports because we, you know, within a week or so, I think we have another flight going up there, which I was especially going to mention. Another Soyuz spacecraft with three more people going to the space station. You have six up there now. Eventually, you'll have nine. They'll stay there for 10 days, and eventually the spacecraft will come back down, and you'll be back to six. But they had to relocate this spacecraft. You know, when you're on board the space station, the flight rules are, if you have five people there, you need enough seats in case of an emergency. If you have six people, if you have nine people, if you have 10, 13 people, you need enough seats for whatever it is in case it's an emergency so everybody can get out and leave. What you have is you need to relocate the spacecraft. So three guys got into, including Mark Kelly, an American, got into this Soyuz spacecraft and they undocked and they moved the Soyuz to another port. And then that frees up the next port coming up there with the other three people. And the reason all three have to get in to do this is, again, if there's an emergency, you can't just have one, you know, they really only need one to do it. But, you know, the commander of the Russians could get into it and move the spacecraft over. But no, if he does that, now you won't have enough seats in case there's an emergency. So all three guys get into the Soyuz spacecraft and they relocate. And then they come back into the other port and they're good to go. That's called docking, and the docking port is around, let's call it 3 feet, it's a little bit bigger, but 3 feet in diameter. They can open up the port, they open up the door and go in, and if your body is 3 feet or whatever equipment you're bringing back and forth is 3 feet, wide, no problem. But say you wanted to bring in big racks, or science racks or something like that, well, it's not going to be able to come through a docking port. So you need a bigger space. And that's where they use the berthing ports on the American side. The Russians can't bring big stuff into their side. You know, if they want something, if we want to bring something in big, need more room, you need roughly 53 inches, I'm going to guess without looking up, roughly 53 inches squared. Now you've got a square opening. Not a round opening like the docking people have. The square opening, also around the square, has this circumference with 16 bolts. And when you're going to berth another spacecraft, such as a cargo spacecraft, or what they did recently, they relocated the multi-purpose module from one location on the space station to another one. They needed to unberth that module and then reberth it somewhere else. Again, it has this big door. When you look at pictures of the International Space Station, especially from the American side, you see all these big doors, these big square doors behind them. But if you look at it close, around the outside, it's a round diameter, probably 54 inches in diameter. And that is what you need for berthing. And the reason there's a big difference between berthing and docking is, I remember on key here, that the reason for it is, if there's an emergency, it's very nice to jump into a Russian spacecraft, or when we had the shuttle going up there, to jump, you know, go through the pressure mating adapter, PM. They had this pressure mating adapter. This one location on the International Space Station that docked to the space station. You go through that again, roughly about 38, 37 inches in diameter, same as the Russians. You put your body through. that and get into the space shuttle, and they could disconnect very quickly within minutes. You could disconnect from the space station. Doors closed, and you disconnect. You don't have these 16 bolts that have to be driven and undriven, like a big flange. When the H2 that just went up there, it took time. After they get a hold of it with a robotic arm, it comes near the space station, they bring it to the bottom of the Harmony node where the birthing procedure takes place at this time. And they set it up, they get it to where it's got to go, this camera that looks in, and they realigned it, and then these bolts eventually get caught, and then they have these powerful motors on each bolt that run these bolts up to some 60,000 PSI pressure, and these 16 bolts all get driven in. This takes a couple of hours, so if there was an emergency or a problem, let's get off the space station. You don't have a couple of hours to get through the birthing procedure. It takes a couple of hours to reverse everything. You want to get out 1, 2, 3. So there's the basic difference between birthing and docking. I hope I answered it, Dick. I probably didn't. Back to you, WS2N.
From my point of view, you did a very good job of answering that one, Paul. So 54 inches square is the aperture of a birthing location. That's 2,916 square inches. If the air pressure inside the International Space Station was 10 pounds per square inch, that's 29,160 pounds of air pressure, 14 and a half, almost 15 tons. I can see why you've got these 16 bolts, because they've got to withstand 15 tons of air pressure. If it's at 10,000 pounds per square inch, 10 pounds per square inch, I think I remember you telling me that the International Space Station runs at normal Earth surface air pressure, 14.7 pounds per square inch. What is the air pressure inside the International Space Station, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they're running 14.7 pounds per square inch. They have nitrogen tanks up there, and they have oxygen, of course. And it's basically the same ratio as Earth, too. You know, you have the only thing that, you know, like, there we say, 21% oxygen and almost 80% nitrogen. You know, they'll say it's 78%, and then there's 1 or 2% that's argon and everything else. Well, they don't have that, so it's oxygen and nitrogen, but 14.7 PSI.
Okay. Then that becomes 42,800 pounds of air pressure. Call it 21 and a half tons. So there's 21 and a half tons of air pressure trying to set. I can see why you got these great big bolts. That's a lot of air pressure. Wow. In the case of docking, yes, it's only a 3-foot diameter hole, which is roughly half the area, half the pressure. What holds the docking vehicle in place? If there's 21 tons trying to separate a birthing vehicle, you're going to get 10 or 12 tons of air pressure trying to separate a docking vehicle. What is the mechanism that holds those two together? And how can that be docked so fast? I've seen docking take place in the case of the movies you see of the command service module coming back to the command module coming, lunar module coming back to the command module. And they got this drogue that captures, and then they get sucked in, and then there's I think it's 12 cleat-like devices around the perimeter to lock the two spacecraft together with a great big rubber seal. I mean, I guess there's something similar to that with a docking vehicle. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they're all kind of similar. Yeah, so, and it, you know, when they always say retracting, you know, so these cleats pull the other unit back together. They have a soft dock, you know. If you look at it, you have to look at it close. It's very hard to understand what they're doing could never seem to find one in motion, but they have a soft dock with the drogue, and then once that's attached, the these clamping like angle, they look like angle irons. I mean, you know, they get grab a hold of the other part of it, and then they, when the motors turn on, they pull themselves together, and that matches the seals match. So there's actually two seals. There's the central ring that's caught by the drogue, and then there's a seal on one side and a seal on the other. They call it a soft dock when the drogue attaches to itself to it, and then when these pull themselves together, they call that a hard dock. That's what's holding the two together, and then they're able to remove the central door. And that's why, you look at the space station, and when the shuttle used to dock, they had this offset contraption, and they called them pressure mating adapters. And what that was on one side, the berthing setup with the 16 bolts on the pressure mating adapter. And on the other side, you had the docking port. And that's what you still have today. Right now, they have a cover in front of it on the astronauts just to remove it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's just a better system that they have. They'll be able to, dock the future spacecraft that come up, Dragon and the CST-100 from Boeing or anybody else.
Stand by a minute. We've got to reset the machine. I think the, eastern port is now operational. Go right ahead.
So this piece that's offset is roughly 22 and a half degree off, actually 21, but I'm going to call it around 21 degree offset from the run of the, I'll call it a fitting, PM pressure mating adapter 1, 2, and 3. There's 3 on board the space station. And the one that they've been docking to for a long time is pressure mating adapter 2. And number 3 has been put off to the side and eventually going to be used. That whole setup, one side is a berthing connection to the space station. The other side has the docking port. Now, one of the missions, and it unfortunately didn't work out because the Falcon 9 blew up recently back in June, had the new docking port, the international docking adapter, one of the new ones on it, which cost, I don't know how many millions of dollars, but that thing was lost and wound up in the Atlantic Ocean. But they want to bump that onto pressure mating adapter 1, and then all future spacecraft will be able to dock to pressure mating adapter 2, and able to get inside the spacecraft that way. They want to set up 2 of these, so you'll be able to have 2 proved spacecraft attached to the space station at one time, and at the same time you'll eventually have 2 ports for cargoes. I mean, theoretically, you'll have 4 locations, 2 docking ports for crews, and plus 2 berthing ports for cargo.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Much, but they're definitely going to be doing that. It's part of the plan. Everything's all laid out. They will be doing that. Side with 2 cargo craft attached and 2 crewed vehicles attached. That's the goal of the whole setup for the next couple of years. Back to you, Dick.
What I'm picturing right now, Paul, is that if that rubber seal around the perimeter of the berthing port or the docking port has a slight tear in it, bump in it, a piece of foreign material in it, that air starts leaking through, or the rubber seal itself becomes damaged because you're moving a large piece of equipment and you hit the rubber seal by mistake, or you can get into a situation where you can never properly operate that particular docking port again in that particular vehicle. I mean, what's the backup? I think you told me there's two separate rubber seals, an inner and an outer, and maybe that's it, there's redundancy there. But if there wasn't redundancy in those seals, and one of those seals becomes damaged, you're in a heap of trouble. You may not be able to unload that cargo that's on that vehicle, and you may not be able to put anything back into it, because I presume this module where you do the docking and berthing has itself another airtight door, but you can't open that other airtight door if you can't make that seal to the berthing vehicle or the docking vehicle, if you can't make that seal work right. You're very dependent on that seal being a very good seal that doesn't leak air. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW. What's the backup on that?
They're very good at it. Every time they dock, close the door, open the door, even on these EBAs, when they go out the Quest unit or on the Russian side, they go out the PS docking port. It's just, and they literally go out of a docking port. On the American side, we have the Quest module. Well, all these modules that are interconnected, every one, I tried to say this before, but the Quest is attached to Unity on one side. Unity is a module. Module on one side has Destiny on one side. The opposite of Unity, going the other way, has another pressure mating adapter. Pressure mating adapter one. And that has, it's berthed, and then on the other side of that, you would say, okay, where's the docking port? Well, that docking port is actually attached to the Russian side. Now, the Russian side, they go off with their series of modules. They have functioning cargo block module, and then followed by the Zesda module. And then they have modules going to the Zenith and to the nadir of that, with all different interconnecting pieces. All these seals, and then now you're going the other way. Let me drop it. Thought it was Quest in the middle. Quest was attached to Destiny, and then, Destiny, Quest was attached to Unity module, and Unity had two different directions. One went off to the pressure mating adapter, one to pick up the Russians, going out the other way, the other run of the Unity module, you're picking up Destiny, which is a big freaking module. Everybody in the United States has our science module. And then after that, you're attached to something called Harmony, which is another node or another module similar to Unity. Again, with berthing units going out of the starboard connection of that, you have another big module as big as Destiny, built by the European Space Agency called Columbia. That has another berthing module attached to Harmony. Going out of the other end of Harmony, you've got Kaibo. Kaibo is the biggest one going. That's 30 feet long by the Japanese. The nadir of that, you have another module attached also by Japan. These modules are all over the place. Pressure mating adapt, the one they just moved it, again, that's attached to another, Tranquility, another module. Every one of these have these big rings, these roughly 54-inch diameter things with 16 bolts sticking out of it. Never had a leak. I mean, they check the leaks every time they do it, but I probably timed out back in there.
Okay, I'm seeing something here that I never knew before. They've got a kind of step and repeat universalness. What's the word I'm looking for here? If every one of the modules interconnected with the adjacent module by way of a berthing port, 54-inch square, that means you have the ability to either connect another module on that port, or if you didn't connect the module yet, you can use it for berthing of the right kind of a berthing vehicle, a cargo vehicle. So in other words, I have the impression that all of the modules per se are interconnected by a standard berthing port, and every one of these berthing ports has got 16 bolts that hold it all together with a huge rubber seal, one or two of them, and I presume there's a door on each one that can be closed so that you can seal off that port, that berthing port, if there isn't a module or a progress-like ship there. Is that true, Paul? Are all of the interconnects berthing ports of exactly 54 inches square with 16 bolts? WS2M, KQIW?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's why every time you see a news report or something of an astronaut floating in the space station, and they're talking to the, you know, to Katie Couric or something, and they're going on and on. I mean, the first question I would ask, and they never do, which module are you in? Because they all look the same. You look behind them, and here's this big square door. I couldn't tell you if they were in the Quest module, the Kaibo module. You know, I just don't know. And nobody ever asked that question. First question I'd say, which module are you in? And when you look behind, there's always a square door. You'll look at it, you'll see a square door. Even in Destiny now, they have a big LCD TV that they brought up there. Not an LCD. They have a screen that they can roll down so they can watch TV. Looks like an LCD screen. And it rolls down right in front of this 54-inch door, you know. You know. Well, if they had the screen down, I'd be able to say, well, you're in Destiny. But you just never know unless they tell you. Back to you, Jeff.
I can sort of see why an interviewing news reporter will not ask what module you're in. First of all, they're probably not able to name the modules. I can't even name the modules very well. And so they don't even know that there are separate modules with separate names. From their point of view, the astronaut is on the International Space Station. There's this great big thing in the sky, as big as a football field, at the International Space Station. You're getting into the fine details of the names of the individual modules. Now, each of these individual modules has a berthing port on each end, and each berthing port has a door on the inside that can be closed. So, in theory, at the intersection between two modules, you've got a berthing port with 16 bolts that are holding it all together, and you've got a door on each side that can be closed. And that door itself, when it's closed, that's the easy way, because the air pressure inside of the vehicle is trying to push the door toward the seal. So my guess is the door is not held down with 16 bolts. Each one of those doors is probably held down with some kind of a very simple latch. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, KQIW?
Yeah, it looks like that. When they pull up, you'll see the square door. When they pull up on it, it almost looks like a garage door with one piece, the way it slides up. You know, it's not a garage door. You have like four different sections. It's like one section. You pull it up and it rolls up and away and above the astronaut when they lift it up. And forget about the Russian side a little bit. I'm not too sure about the berthing system on that. You know, that might be a little different. But I mean, if you work from one end to the other, you stop from the Russians and you go all the way forward. Forget about solar panels or anything else with trusses and how everything's put together. But if you look at all the cylinders, you start back by where the Russians are. Forget about the spacecraft that they come up in. They're attached somewhere. But when you start from the back, you have the Zvezda. That's the main living quarters and science section for the Russians. They have a bathroom and everything in there. They're connected to the next module forward. The Zarya. Zarya is they call it the functioning cargo box. Let's call it a machine room. That's what big batteries and all kinds of stuff are. That's the next room. Now, if you come forward, you have the pressure mating adapter number one. That adapts the Russians to the Americans. That's why you have, on the Russian side, you have almost like a docking port, and on the American side, you have the berthing port. We drop it. Now you keep going forward again. That is now attached to Unity. Unity is another, let's call it, it's a good size module, but it's another node. The reason it was made was to make all these different connecting ports. It has six of these opening, six of these merging ports that you could attach to. So, it's attached to Unity. Now you keep going forward again. We're going in line. We're not going anywhere else, but we're going in line. Now you're going forward again, and that Unity